This is the State of Things from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stachow. I could keep this introduction simple and say that Jennifer Ho's family came from China, but that would be like keeping a review of Tolstoy's War and Peace simple by saying it's about Russia. In fact, Jennifer's father's family fled communist China, while her mother's family made their way from China to Jamaica and then to the States. This makes Jennifer first-generation American, and today she's thinking about what it means to be Chinese-American below the Mason-Dixon line. Jennifer Ho is an English professor at the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill, and my guest today. Welcome. Good to have you here.
Good to be back. Thank you.
Tell us a little bit about your family. Start with your father's side of the family. How and why did they leave China?
So my grandfather, paternal grandfather, was a banker. He spoke 10 different Chinese languages, and he was basically the go-between during World War II for the Kuomintang Army and the U.S. Army.
That would be the Nationalist Army.
That would be the Nationalist Army, right. Legend or rumor has it that given his access to U.S. currency, he skimmed from the top. That's fairly widely accepted in my family. And an important thing to note, because he was able to take U.S. currency out of China when they fled. So I think given his connections, given to finance, given his connections to, I mean, he was a fairly important person, which means that he was sure to be in a re-education camp during the communist era. So he and my grandmother and their five children, they have six kids, but the oldest daughter was already married and living in the United States. So they pretended to go visit an aunt of my grandmother's, and walked away from their house, walked away from this huge house, these servants, and took with them only what they could carry in suitcases, pretending that they were going on vacation. And what they did was they sewed these dollar bills into the linings of coats. They hollowed out shoes and put gold nuggets in the heels of shoes. They took the baby formula canister that my youngest aunt was an infant, and they basically took these $100 bills and rolled them up really small and put them in the bottom of this baby formula bottle.
Yeah. And where did they move in the U.S.? They came here?
So they moved around for a while in China, or rather in Formosa, which was then Taiwan, Hong Kong, and Macau. And I think the idea was they would see what was happening. So because it wasn't, I think history, of course, we now know, yes, Mao came to power. But at the time when this was all playing out, it was not a done deal. You know, there was a question mark about whether or not he would stay in power or whether he would be ultimately overthrown. When it was understood that he was ultimately going to stay in power, they were living in Taiwan and had run through all of their funds. And it was about 6 years after they fled. And again, at the time, because my oldest aunt was living in the U.S. with a Chinese-American Baptist preacher, they were sponsored to come to New York City. And that is how my dad's side of the family ended up in New York, and it's why I was born in Queens.
What was it like for your grandfather and your father in that experience growing up, or for him now living in New York?
I wish I had more direct stories. My grandfather, by the time he ended up in New York City's Chinatown, was 50 years old. And from the time he came to the U.S., he didn't work a day in his life. Which is a little unusual. I think we know of all sorts of immigrant stories of people who were doctors or bankers or businessmen and had very powerful lives and then came to the America and worked as janitors or cab drivers. I think my grandfather never learned to be fluent in English. He understood more than he could speak. And I think ultimately he was too proud. I think he was too proud to be somebody in China who commanded so much power and influence. And who could speak so many languages, to be reduced to being seen as an illiterate immigrant. And, you know, we're talking about 1950s U.S., and so he was certainly not treated with a lot of respect outside of the confines of Chinatown. So I think he had, you know, I mean, I never saw him outside of a suit. Like, in my entire life, he's always worn a suit. And I think for my father, it must have been traumatic. Like, when I got to college and I started to learn more about Chinese history and Asian American history, I came home and I tried to ask my dad questions. And he just said he didn't remember. Now, whether he really doesn't remember or whether he didn't want to talk to me about these stories, I'm not exactly certain. So what I know of my family's stories come largely through extended family members.
So that's your father's side of the family. Your mother's story is far different than that.
Yeah. My mom, growing up, liked to tell me that I have aristocracy on my dad's side and I'm a peasant on my mom's side. So my mom's family were poor villagers, I guess, outside of Hong Kong. And at the time, my maternal grandfather was the second to youngest son. So he didn't stand to inherit the farm and had to go make his fortune. So he jumped on a freighter and it took him to Jamaica, where one of his older brothers already was working in some kind of soda factory. Decided, I guess, that there was a chance for him to make a living, came back to Hong Kong, where he married my grandmother. It's a little fuzzy about whether it was an arranged marriage or not. Undoubtedly, there was probably some type of arrangement. I don't think that they were necessarily childhood sweethearts, but I don't think that it was forced either on my grandmother's part. So he stayed long enough to basically marry her and get her pregnant, and then went back to Jamaica. No, so she stayed behind in China, which was this was very typical in the Chinese diaspora, especially in the late 19th and early 20th century, that Chinese men would go overseas and they would oftentimes not bring back their wives because the living conditions were oftentimes very poor. And certainly the traveling conditions were precarious. So my grandmother did eventually go and join my grandfather, and it took her, I think, 3 boats and an overland train trip across Canada to be able to do that. Leaves behind her baby daughter with relatives, goes to Jamaica. World War II breaks out. She doesn't see her oldest daughter until after the war, until 10 years later. And that's kind of another story. But she ends up in Jamaica and has 8 children. So my grandmother's had 9 kids.
Wow. What kind of work was your grandfather doing?
He opened up a bakery. So if there's any Chinese Jamaicans listening, he opened up the Caribbean Bakery in Kingston. And it's funny when I run into the Chinese Jamaican community worldwide is a fairly small group, as you can imagine. So when I run into other people who have Chinese Jamaican family members and, you know, we kind of go through family connections. The minute I mention my grandfather's bakery, most people say, oh, yeah, I remember that or I recognize that from Kingston.
And what was it like for him and his family on that island?
Well, unfortunately, I've never met him. He died when my mom was 16. So, but I think that even though they were living in Jamaica, the stories that I have of my mother's family largely come from my mom, in addition to my aunts and uncles, whom I'm all still really close to. And I think for all intents and purposes, he was a pretty traditional Chinese man. And what I mean by that is the stories that my mother shared with me, in part, had to do with what her life was like growing up as the eldest daughter in a family that was almost all boys. And one of the things that she had to do was she had to wake up at 5 o'clock every morning and open up the gate so that my grandfather could drive to the bakery. And that seems odd and inexplicable to me that he would make his daughter wake up at 5 o'clock in the morning just to open up a gate that he wasn't, you know, capable of stepping out of his car, opening up the gate himself. But I think that was, again, that was kind of a part of a Chinese tradition that's the role of the oldest daughter. And so that's what she had to do.
She then moved actually from Jamaica then to the U.S. Right?
She did by way of a nursing degree in Guildford, England. Yes.
Wow.
Yeah.
So that's a completely different experience. And if we think about Chinese immigration to the U.S., we don't really think about it in that way. That in fact, had she ever gone to China or Taiwan?
No. In fact, I would say my mother's never set foot, as far as I know, on the Asian continent.
No. So when did she come to the U.S. and what was her experience?
So she left Jamaica at the age of 17. My mother doesn't like to think of herself this way, but she's a real pioneer. You know, I mean, think about it. You're 17 years old. You're going to leave, you know, this tiny island nation that you've ever known. And you're going to go to nursing school in England. It's a place you've never been to before, you know. And apparently that was a pretty common thing. There were other girls from her high school that also went, but she was the youngest in her class, apparently. Spent 2 years in nursing school in Guildford, England, and then was going to come back to Jamaica, but there was a layover in New York City. A friend of hers had an aunt who lived in Manhattan. And so they stayed. And it turned out that there was a job for her at Beth Israel Hospital. And so she didn't return to Jamaica. She stayed and got an apartment in New York and got working at Beth Israel.
Wait, obviously, it's going to be different living in Jamaica and living in New York. But again, if you think about a group of people who are the other in Jamaica and the other in New York,
right.
Can she compare those experiences? Is it different being?
Well, I think my mother probably always felt different. And I think this is something I can really relate to because her experience wouldn't have been common with anyone living, for example, in New York City Chinatown. My mother grew up not speaking Mandarin or Cantonese. I think she, and actually, technically speaking, my paternal family speaks Hakka. They're Hakka Chinese rather than Cantonese. And the Hakka are a minority group within southern China. So my grandmother, who, by the way, is still alive to this day, she just turned 100
a few weeks ago. Wow.
Yeah, she looks great. We had a big party for her in Toronto. So my grandmother speaks this really odd mishmash of Hakka Chinese and English and Jamaican Patois. And my mother speaks Jamaican Patois. So, you know, if you listen closely enough, you can hear the Jamaican accent. And when you get her around other Caribbean speakers, you know, that Patois comes out.
On the State of Things today, talking with Jennifer Ho, an English professor at the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. Our conversation continues on the State of Things from North Carolina Public Radio, a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. Please stay with us. This is the State of Things broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stachow. Jennifer Ho is with me. She is an English professor at the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill, talking about her experience here in the South with these fairly complicated immigration patterns to the United States. And there was a time when you really hated being Chinese as a young girl.
Yes, there was. It's not something I'm proud to announce, particularly since I study race and Asian American literature. But I went through a phase of ethnic self-loathing, which I think in some ways is probably not unusual in the U.S. And it's odd, I think, because I grew up in a pretty diverse neighborhood, and I had Chinese-American and Asian-American friends, as well as African-American and Chicano friends. So it wasn't like I was living in an all-white enclave, but I think that I had still absorbed, you know, the kind of social and cultural norms about whiteness and about, you know, the value of whiteness. And so there are kind of two ways in which I would say my ethnic self-hatred manifested in this period. And the first was that I knew I wanted to be a writer. From a very young age, I loved narrative and stories, and I wanted to be a creative writer. And I would go to my local library and, you know, kind of imagine where my books would sit on the shelf. But, and again, this is sad and embarrassing, I couldn't imagine publishing under my last name. I couldn't imagine that they would publish somebody who was Chinese American. And so I thought I would have to invent a pseudonym. And in fact, I did. I had this all planned out. My pseudonym was going to be Jacqueline Hope, H-O-P-E. And so I would look to where Hope would be in the bookshelves, right? Because it just didn't dawn on me that Asian Americans wrote or that I could be published as an Asian American.
This is an interesting way, it seems to me, and an insight into how you can internalize these norms, this kind of what it means to be normal. And it means having a name like Jacqueline Hope,
right,
and not Jennifer Ho. Which, did you experience any overt discrimination?
No, I really. I mean, was I called chink? Yes. Were there a number of microaggressions? Yes. Did I ever feel like my life was in danger? No. And do I ever feel like I missed opportunities based on my race? That one's a little hard to say, but the fact that I have tenure at the UNC Chapel Hill makes me think, no, I can't really say that anyone actively prevented me based on my race or ethnicity from achieving.
And I really wanted to stop and kind of make this point because for people like me who never have to think about their identity or what the norms are for me, it doesn't mean. The fact that you haven't been prevented access, the fact that there weren't huge examples of overt racism or discrimination, doesn't mean that you can't live your life without this kind of dual identity.
Right. No, absolutely. And I think, I mean, certainly this is one of the things I talk about in my classes, right, that I think we think of racism in a very narrow way, with a very narrow set of definitions, like somehow they are overt actions, just in the way that you were describing them. They're preventing someone from achieving success or endangering their life. And certainly that's been the case throughout American history, so I'm in no way trying to discount that kind of racism. But I think the reason why I use the word microaggression is that, you know, I didn't think I was, and this is sort of a weird thing to say, I didn't think I was pretty for a long time. And I'm not trying to say, because this is radio, so who knows what I look like. I'm not trying to say that I am pretty or attractive, but I'm saying that I grew up really believing that I was ugly purely based on my ethnicity, purely based on the fact that I wasn't white. For me, the standard of beauty was blonde hair, blue eyes. And I didn't think that because I didn't have access to that, then I just naturally assumed that I was not an attractive girl. And I would say that it wasn't until I got to college that those ideas really changed.
And again, it's interesting to think about how subtly that idea came to you. Nobody said you can't be a cheerleader because you're Chinese, but right. Subtly you absorbed the norm that this is what pretty is, because I'm watching this gaze, and it seems to be going in that direction.
Absolutely, you know, right.
And also, let's go back to the story about the writer, because you, as you said, you couldn't imagine your name as on the byline, as the author of a book. And then something changed for you on a trip to, of all places, Costco.
Yes, I was home my freshman year of college, and I saw this book cover, and it was Amy Tan's Joy Luck Club. It was 1989, and Amy Tan wasn't the first Chinese American writer that I ever read. I'd been taking a class at Santa Barbara, UC Santa Barbara. Intro to Asian American Studies. So Maxine Hong Kingston's Woman Warrior, I credit as my kind of first Asian American work that I read. But the Tans was a novel. The way that the Kingston book was taught was as a memoir. And that was revelatory. But seeing Amy Tan's book and reading that and kind of seeing it in Costco, right, not assigned to me on my syllabus, but widely available for all shoppers, that was revelatory, and I tore through that book, and Amy Tan is why I became an English major and an English professor. And there, within Asian American literary studies, we have certain feelings about Amy Tan that aren't necessarily laudatory in the way that I'm now talking about her. But I will say that I think whatever else I might think about her total body of work, what I think about the Joy Luck Club is that it was profound. It was a profound shift in the way that the publishing industry and the American readership understood Asian American writing.
And just to give a sense of the depth of your feelings about yourself before these revelations, before you could, you know, sort of check yourself against different norms, you had an experience I think it was a high school or maybe junior high school dance, right, where everybody was sitting around and making phone calls. And
yes. So, you know, this is the other story, I guess, of my, that demonstrates my ethnic self-loathing. It was a high school dance. I think I must have been a freshman because we were all calling, at the end of the dance, we were all calling our parents to get rides home. And again, I always had Asian American friends, you know, so standing around this telephone booth was, you know, a friend of mine, Yuko, whose parents are Japanese immigrants, Alice, who's Korean American, and another friend who's Filipino, whose name is now escaping me. And, you know, each of them got on the phone and spoke in Japanese, Korean, Tagalog to their parents to come pick them up. And Yuko turned to me and she said, "Wow, isn't it great that we can all be speaking these different languages, you know, to our parents, right?" And that, which is great, which is such a great attitude. My response was, no, right? My response was like, what's your problem? Like, why aren't you speaking English to your parents, right? Like, you're in America, you should be speaking English. I mean, it's so, again, embarrassing to admit that now, you know, although I think you know, for any 14-year-olds out there listening,
yeah.
you can have a total life change.
Right. And I do think, and also in some ways, the kind of superficial way that we treat multiculturalism as though we have somehow arrived at a pinnacle when there's clearly a lot of work to be done. I mean, I think that's the other part of that story.
Oh, yes, absolutely. And I think our ideas about ethnicity, multiculturalism, race, I think all of those things are malleable, right? So, you know, if I were to look and hear my 14-year-old self, I'd be appalled, right? I'd just be, you know, and want to shake her. But clearly, my thinking changed. And I think my thinking changed because I credit my parents. You know, my parents did a really good job of instilling a sense of equity and fairness that I've carried throughout my life.
What else changed? What else helped you see that 14-year-old as not quite as attractive as you might have felt you were at the moment in your zeal for English?
I think college was certainly a revelatory experience for me. College was the place where I took women's studies courses and African-American studies courses and my first Asian-American studies course. And it was really that first Asian-American studies course, which Santa Barbara was on the quarter system. So this was winter quarter, my second semester, second term in school. And I was blown away. I mean, it felt like someone cut open the top of my head, took out my brain, and replaced it with this totally other new thing. And I just kept asking myself, why didn't I learn this earlier? Right? Why didn't I know about the history about the Japanese-American internment earlier? Why didn't I know there was the 1882 Exclusion Act? And really, the most profound moment was the day that I learned of the small act of Congress that allowed for 150 refugees from communist China to be allowed entry into the United States. So the 1882 Exclusion Act actually wasn't repealed formally until the 1960s. And so there was still this kind of quota immigration system going on for immigrants from China. But because during the Cold War era, of course, we wanted to support anyone who was trying to flee communism, Congress passed an act that allowed for 150 refugees to come over. My family was one of those 150. And that was an incredible moment for me to understand that my family had a connection to American history. We were part of American history in a really deep way.
It's interesting, too, though, those other parts of American history are the parts that should confirm your desire to assimilate. I mean, these are all the bad things that happened to Chinese people. So you might be forgiven for wanting to run away from that past and those people who had been discriminated against and as quickly as you can become one of the other people who've always had the privilege. I mean, why did that change you and make you more sympathetic?
I think, again, it's the idea of wanting things to be fair. Mm-hmm. You know, like as a kid, I always wanted things to be fair. I remember telling my fourth grade teacher, Mrs. Carter, that's just not fair. And she said, life's not fair, Jennifer, get used to it. And that really made me mad, right? I was 10 years, I was 10, 11, you know. I thought that was a terrible thing to tell a child. And I've always wanted things to be fair. And I guess, again, pointing back to my parents, I mean, my parents are pretty humble people. And never, you know, the goal in life for them is for me to lead a happy life. They were not, you know, I think you hear these stereotypes about, you know, privileging boys, right, over mm-hmm. girls. And both my grandfather, my dad's dad, and my dad, I would say, never treated me in that way. In fact, if anything, they favored me. And my mom used to say that I was my grandfather's favorite grandchild. And I don't know if that's really true. I mean, there's a ton of us. And so that's kind of not a nice thing to think about playing favorites. But I will say that I was treated really well. And I was expected to do, I was expected I could do anything. And that was given, that was because of my parents. And so I think when I got to college and I started to learn about this history, this sense of social justice was really, you know, kind of flourished, right? That had been maybe lying dormant. And I think I had been processing things as a teenager in high school about my identity and wanting to fit in, right? And I think that's a normal developmental process. And I think I got to college and I realized that there were different ways that I could be, right? And that's one of the really wonderful things about being in college is you realize that there are all sorts of different types of people. You don't just have to be one way.
That is fascinating, too, because it points to the need that each of us has to develop an identity personally and tell ourselves a story about ourselves that's plausible, culturally. So we have stories, we have narratives about immigration, about rising, you know, up from one generation to another, the great melting pot and all of that, stories of multiculturalism. Are they different from place to place? Is it different to be Chinese American in the South?
Oh, undoubtedly. And, you know, I think I sometimes talk about my experiences growing up in California in the Bay Area in a kind of idyllic way, right? Because I grew up in such a multi-ethnic, multi-racial community with people who were themselves mixed race, I think, which, you know, again, I grew up in the 70s and 80s, was not usual, I would say, even though I kind of internalize a desire for whiteness. I think when you're the only one, like, I don't know what it's like to be the only one, right? Like, I always had family members, I always had friends who were either Chinese American themselves or Asian, and who had the similar experiences. And so I imagine if you grow up and you're the only Chinese American kid in a small rural town in North Carolina, that's a hard experience, right? The pressure to assimilate, the pressure to kind of try and be like everyone else, the ability to find counter narratives and other stories is more difficult.
And the story in the South has always been, don't you think, a binary, a black-white binary, in ways that in other cities, in other places in the North and Northeast, it hasn't been, because there's this history of immigration, people from other places. And I wonder if that makes it different. How do you fit into this binary, you know, and how do folks try to fit you in to a story that has always been black and white, or primarily black and white?
I mean, that was one of my primary concerns in moving to the South. How would I be read? So I came here in 2003 on a postdoc, a two-year postdoc that I didn't think would lead to a tenure-track job. I'm, you know, over the moon that it did. But at the time, I was wary, and I had my own set of stereotypes about the South. And I asked, I was living in Massachusetts at the time, and I asked two friends, one who was a white Southerner and one who was a black Southerner, how I'd be treated moving to North Carolina. And both of them said, you'll be treated like you're white. Don't worry. And what I told them was, I do worry, right? Like that's not the reassuring answer for me. And I moved here, and actually I've had both black and white Southerners tell me to my face that for all intents and purposes, Asians are white. That in other words, there is this idea that by virtue of my Asian race, I get honorary whiteness. I think that might be perceived to be true, but I actually don't believe that it is true. In other words, I can certainly think of situations in which I do not think that I register as white. I think every time someone asks me where I'm from, or how I get to speak good English, I am not registering as white.
Well, and you were on a panel recently where you actually used the phrase white supremacy, and that surprised one of your panel members. Right?
Yes, a few years ago I was asked to be on a panel talking about the education gap for Orange County School District. So it was largely educators in the room, and I was invited to talk about the Asian American perspective. And I talked about white supremacy, I talked about white privilege as institutions and as ways, these things that guide our educational system. And afterwards, the woman who invited me said that one of her colleagues, who was African American, turned to her and said, I can't believe this woman is speaking so openly about white supremacy. And I think what my colleague was saying was that for this African American Southern woman, I think she'd never expected to see someone who was Asian American to take on this issue, right? And that I did have an understanding of the way that white supremacy operated and was not afraid to name it.
Well, and that probably has to do with the fact that white supremacy and privilege, the privilege built on white supremacy and the immoral use of free enslaved labor was always a binary, but it changed after the Civil War from kind of family-owned businesses to a corporate finance structure that really encouraged much more inflow and much more diversity, but also had to encourage that kind of division that keeps, you know, sort of people from noticing where their hard-earned labor is going.
Yes, unfortunately, I think creating a stratified, racialized labor system is something that the U.S. has been pretty good at doing for the last couple of centuries, right? So right after, you know, after the Civil War with the end of slavery and even before that with the end of the transatlantic slave trade, I think people were thinking about what other cheap sources of labor can we bring in, which is one of the reasons that Chinese labor was recruited on the West Coast to build the railroads. And I think seeing that succeed, business people in the South thought, huh, can we bring in these Chinese laborers to replace our former slaves and work on plantations?
And so the story is a little slower to change than the actual than the action on the ground. We've seen much more diversity here, but that story about a black and white dyad down here is something that just is a little slower to change.
Right. Although, you know, I suspect that it's never been absolutely true. Like everything else, I think that's the story that we tell ourselves about the South, right? That it's this black and white dyad. Right. But there have been Native Americans and people from Latin America.
Let me take a break here. We want to talk more about that. Jennifer Ho is my guest, English professor at UNC Chapel Hill, and our conversation continues in a moment. Stay tuned. This is The State of Things. I'm Frank Stachow, talking with Jennifer Ho, English professor at the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. Before the break, we're talking about a very complex history here in the South, but it tends to get reduced to this kind of black-white story. You wrote a paper entitled Southern Eruptions and Asian American Narratives, and you make reference to a scene from the animated TV series King of the Hill, in which Texas native Hank Hill and his local buddies are talking about their new neighbor, Khan, who has emigrated from Laos. Let's listen.
So are you Chinese or Japanese?
I live in California last 20 years, but first come from Laos.
Huh?
Laos. We Laotian.
The ocean? What ocean?
We are Laotian from Laos, stupid. It's a landlocked country in Southeast Asia. It's between Vietnam and Thailand, okay? Population 4.7 million.
So are you Chinese or Japanese?
There it is. You really didn't have to write a paper after that.
No.
So tell us about that and that kind of experience here in the South.
Well, I think humorously what that clip has demonstrated is that we tend to think of Asians as Chinese or Japanese, right? I mean, we tend to think of reduce them to being one of two possibilities, when the truth of the matter is Asia is this huge continent. And there have been immigrants who've been driven through various forces into the United States, most notably U.S. imperialism in the form of various wars in Asia, most recently in, you know, Southeast Asia.
Vietnam, yeah.
Yeah. And so that you know, yes, it's about the South. In some ways, that could be other places. You know, I don't want to perpetuate this idea of the South as this kind of regional backwater in the way that I think the King of the Hill is trying to, you know, kind of poke fun of these Texans. But I do think that because immigrants from Asia have been slower to come into the South, that idea that somehow there's only one type of Asian or that, you know, or Asians are this way is probably something that does happen more in the South than it has in other places in the U.S. where there's been more Asian immigration that's happened through a longer period of time.
You also talk about you recently or had been diagnosed with breast cancer, and that's been an important part of your writing and your thinking recently. First of all, tell us about that, about being diagnosed and why you decided to be so public about it.
So it was late March. I felt a lump, and I decided I should go to the doctor just in case, you know, it was something. I can't tell you how close I literally didn't go to my doctor. Like, there was actually just this part of my brain that was like, oh, this can't possibly be anything, right? I'm 40, you know, I'm too young. And I thought, well, whatever, I'll waste a copay, I'll go see her. That, of course, set off a chain reaction that led me to getting, on April 15th, a positive diagnosis of cancer in both breasts, stage 2 in my right and DCIS or stage 0 in my left, which then led to 4 months of chemotherapy treatment, a bilateral mastectomy, and I'm currently on anti-cancer drugs right now.
And you had, in addition to all of this, quite a reaction to what you saw in the doctor's office when you went in. Test.
I did. So on the day that I went to go get my biopsy, they were leading me to an exam room. And, you know, I have to say that prior to this, I hadn't given much thought to, I guess, the discourse around breast cancer. I mean, like everyone else, I was well aware of breast cancer and that I needed to screen myself. And I had, unfortunately, I have family members. I have two aunts on my dad's side and an aunt on my mom's side who've had breast cancer. So I knew what that looked like. But I just thought, you know, I'm young and I, you know, this isn't about me. And then I saw a tote bag with UNC Hospital's name on it and then the pink ribbon. And I had this immediate visceral reaction. And I'm walking with the nurse and I said something that I can't repeat on the air. But I said, you know, I hate those pink ribbons. And we can add an adjective mm-hmm. in there somewhere. And, you know, this is the South. And the nurse looks at me, you know, because I get these norms wrong all the time, right? These kind of Southern gendered, you know, female norms all the time. And I just thought, oh, I've blown it. you know, I'm like, I'm not a good patient and I'm not being ladylike. And the nurse looked at me and she said, what did you say? And I said, if I actually do have breast cancer, I am never wearing a pink ribbon. And she laughed. I mean, luckily she laughed. I think she kind of understood that I was anxious and, you know. And then, you know, I got a phone call the next day telling me that I had breast cancer. And it's hard to explain what it's like. It's like feeling you've been kicked in the gut and thrown down a set of stairs and then kicked in the teeth. And I decided I was going to be public. I decided that it's part of my personality. I'm an oversharer. And I had lovely friends and family from across the nation who wanted to know what was going on. And so I started this blog, partly as a way to keep people informed, but also I knew that this was going to be how I processed things, so that this would be a form of therapy for me to be able to write what I was experiencing. And I think also there's a part of me that can't turn off the professor in me. So I knew I would also use this experience as a way to really kind of analyze and examine on a meta level, what I was going through.
Well, I want to talk about that and what it means for you personally and how you thought about it. But I want to get back to the pink ribbon and what it was about that and about the pink ribbon culture that set you off.
I think it was this idea that, you know, the moment that I entered into the machinery of UNC Lineberger's Cancer Hospital, and I have nothing but praise, I want to be really clear, about the treatment I received. And the number of wonderful people that I met, and my doctors and nurses, and fellow patients. But I knew I'd be branded, right? Like, I knew that I wasn't going to be Dr. Jennifer Ho. I wasn't just going to be a person who wasn't going to be marked with this label. And the label to me seemed to be tremendously infantilizing and overly feminized and really not respectful of women in their full capacity to handle things. And I think it's especially the infantilization that really got me, you know, like, and the language of this being a journey and a language of, you know, like women who claim that they were glad that they got breast cancer because it taught them all these lessons and, like, you know, they wouldn't trade that experience for the world. And I'm going to sound awfully judgmental about these women, but I just thought, I mean, like, that was the last thing I wanted to hear when I was about to enter chemotherapy and I had to make all these important decisions about my life, as I thought, I'm not glad I have cancer. I don't think this is the best experience in the world. I you know, what lessons I'm going to learn? Like, at the end of the day, if somebody said, you can never have cancer again, right, I would have been like, yay, that's great. You know, and then they said, you know, but you won't come to these great epiphanies. I'd be like, that's fine. You know, I can figure out another way to come to these great epiphanies.
But how much of that was just the anxiety of the moment? Precisely that, because I know that if you step back and think about anybody who has been through a journey like this and has had these epiphanies, I mean, that is something to take away. It's something to be valued. And there is great dignity in that. I'm sure you'd agree. And that there was enormous anxiety at that particular moment that you were feeling that touched this off. So I guess ultimately my question is, what lingers? What about this pink ribbon culture would you say you're still a bit critical of?
Sure. And, you know, the other thing I want to say is that I recognize that in critiquing pink ribbon culture, I run the danger of critiquing women who have breast cancer. And there are friends and family members of mine who've had breast cancer or know intimately women who've had breast cancer, who really see the pink ribbon as something that is empowering, something that's positive, something that they've really, that has really inspired them. And so I don't want my comments to be taken as denigrating any of those experiences. And I think, you know, exactly what you said, Frank, like it was an anxiety response. But I also think it was an intellectual response on some level, and continues to be. So what has lingered is, I think, pink ribbon culture, it obscures what the real issue of cancer is like. So in other words, it's literally putting a pink ribbon, right? It's literally putting this pretty thing on a disease that, I mean, it's probably not appropriate for me to go on the air and explain exactly what I went through in terms of my cancer treatment, my surgeries, the rehabilitation afterwards. But it was hard, right? It was hard. And I say that not to elicit sympathy, but I say that to say that just kind of putting a pink ribbon and saying like, okay, we're gonna make people aware of breast cancer. I mean, the truth is there's lots of different cancers out there. Breast cancer has received a lot of attention, and I'm a beneficiary of that. But ovarian cancer, testicular cancer, prostate cancer, these are all cancers. Lung cancer, I mean, these are all cancers that we should be paying attention to. And really, 80% of cancer is environment driven. So, you know, people talk about like changing your diet or not smoking or not, you know, X, Y, and Z. But the truth of the matter is, I don't know how I got my cancer. I know that it wasn't genetic. It could have been something that my mother was exposed to when she was in Jamaica, that then skipped a generation and then got transferred to me. It could have been something I was living next to some kind of, you know, water pollutant that I didn't know about at some point in my life. And I think that's, again, the thing that just talking about awareness or kind of putting a pink ribbon on things really obscures the deep environmental problems and toxicity in our lives.
That does play into one of the great American stories and the tendency toward exceptionalism, that I can tell the personal story, but in the process obscure some of these larger and more complicated issues, like the environmental factors that are leading to this upsurge in cancer that we're, and then, as you say, put a pink ribbon on it. And identity is so important in this, particularly when it comes to breast cancer and those cancers that threaten to change who you are in a way, in a fundamental way.
Right. Absolutely.
And then replace it with a pink ribbon.
I also think, for better or worse, my reaction was anger. I mean, I was angry. I was so angry when I got diagnosed. I mean, I was looking forward to turning 40. I know that sounds weird, but I thought 40 was going to be my year. You know, prior to getting diagnosed with cancer, and this might be oversharing, but, you know, I got married in May, in Memorial Day weekend. The following week, I was in the hospital getting fitted for a port and then for chemotherapy. So I was diagnosed right before month before the wedding. My husband and I had been trying to get pregnant. I got the diagnosis, and I was told I was going to be thrown into early menopause and wouldn't be able to get pregnant. I mean, there were lots of things that this, you know, radically changed my life, and I was really angry about it. And I was angry about the lack of – I wanted other narratives, right? I mean, it kind of goes back to the Asian American, my attraction to Asian American narratives, right? I wanted stories about other women who were like me, who didn't want to just say, okay, this is a journey I'm going through and I'm going to learn these lessons. I wanted to be angry, and I wanted to say I was angry. I wanted to be with other women who were angry and talk about, you know, this disease and what we could do, and to be empowered. Like, I wanted to really empower myself in my decision making. And I found it was hard.
So is that why the blog, you go public, in other words, to create another way of telling the story and to share it, to let women know they're not alone?
I did. I created the blog, you know, first to as a way of sharing information with friends and family, but then, yes, as a way to process things, as a way to reach out to other women. I actually really didn't think other women would find their way to my blog, and it's still up if anybody wants to read it. I can't say the name on the air. It's No Blanking Pink Ribbons.
that unladylike gerund. You know, all you had to say is, pink ribbon, bless your heart. Well, that would have kind of done it, because that's what that means.
Yeah, I didn't figure out the whole bless your heart thing was not meant sincerely.
That is that gerund here. That's what that gerund is.
It's
a Southern translation.
I should have done that. That would actually have been a great confluence of Southern and cancer narratives. Yeah.
Tell us about your decision. You have been very public. You made the decision not to have reconstructive surgery after a double mastectomy.
Right.
Tell us about that and about the decision. Why?
my breasts were not going to identify me, which isn't to say that I don't miss them, or and it was not an easy decision. I mean, I waffled like I've never waffled before about whether I should do bilateral mastectomy. But actually, I didn't ever waffle about the reconstruction because I didn't – having fake breasts or replacing my breasts felt false to me. It felt like I was trying to recreate a life prior to my diagnosis. And again, I want to be really clear. I think it's fine for women who do it. And in fact, you know, my best friend, when I was sharing with her all my thought process, I mean, she just said, I'd do it in a heartbeat. I don't, you know, she wasn't criticizing me. She was just telling me, like, if she were in my shoes, she would have done it. And I would say probably 90% of women, I think, also would have had the surgery. My Aunt Joyce, my mom's youngest sister, had breast cancer and came out to visit me, and she'd never had reconstruction surgery. And I think in some ways that was helpful, that I had someone really close to me in my life who didn't choose reconstruction. And just the thought of more surgery, I think that was the other thing, the thought of more surgery, the thought that more things could go wrong. And I think what was really interesting in my decision to not do reconstruction was that, A, people second-guessed me all the time. Like, they told me that I was going to change my mind, including my surgeon. Like, he was like, you know, you can always change your mind. Even years from now, you can change your mind. You can get the breasts, which I guess is nice to know, right? That option's out there. But the other really weird patronizing comment that I got and my husband got was feeling like I should do it for him. And he actually had men come up to him who said, you know, are you sure you're not just going to try and talk your wife out of this? Are you sure, like, you know, this is a big deal? And he was really appalled that they would somehow think that that's the number one thing that he's worried about when he wants me to be healthy.
It's interesting, though. You say you waffled. So there was some part, I mean, you had to investigate and then think about how much of your identity had become invested in breasts.
Oh, yeah.
And was it a surprise to you when you explored the question?
No, it wasn't a surprise to me because I definitely didn't want to lose my breasts. I mean, that's the thing. Like, I wanted my breasts. You know, I liked my breasts. They, you know, they functioned well for me throughout my life. They
right.
gave me pleasure, you know, like they made my dresses fit better. I didn't want to lose a body part,
yeah.
right? I mean, that was what it was. It wasn't, I didn't want to lose a body part. But at the end of the day, I didn't think that putting a prosthetic, and I could have been fitted for a prosthetic device, and I haven't, but I just didn't, it didn't feel authentic to who I was.
And you've been very clear about not being judgmental about others and making it very clear that that is a personal decision.
Absolutely.
For you.
Yeah, I would never judge someone else.
Jennifer, always a great pleasure. Please come back. Jennifer Ho, thanks for talking.
Thanks for having me.
Jennifer Ho is an English professor at the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. Find out more at our website, stateofthings.org. Our program is produced by Laura Lee, Nicole Campbell, Megan Modafferi, Sean Nguyen, Phoebe Judge. Robin Copley is the technical director. Brent Wolf is the news director. And this is North Carolina Public Radio, a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. I'm Frank Stachow.